We are in the midst of the account of the history of Noah and his family in chapters 5 through 9. You all remember that? Genesis? Genesis is easy to find because it's the first book in your Bible. So it really, it takes the challenge out of it. You know? So we're going to come back to these chapters and we're going to talk a little bit more this morning. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 8. But before we go there, we will come to this section where we left Noah last week. They were floating on the water of the great Mabul. That word, the worldwide flood of Genesis. The only place in the Bible that word is used is in these chapters. And they are floating in the great ark that Noah had spent 120 years building. And today we're going to start with a video that helps us understand that ark, how it was built and what it looked like. And this video we're going to look at this morning comes from the Creation Science Museum in Kentucky. And that's what we're going to be viewing today. This video will be up in the Dropbox in a smaller form. If you want to go back and watch this, I would encourage it. Now, I've combined last week's video with this one, so it should just go straight through. And so, enjoy. I love that video. I've watched it, I think, 6 or 7 times. This is probably my 6th time since I've gotten it. So, this week, we'll go to the flood receding, Genesis chapter 8. And we'll just go through this. And I want to point out something to you. Notice this. December 26, 2004. This was the great tsunami, the great Indian tsunami. One of the waves that they saw coming in. Someone was able to take a picture of this. This is out away from the coast, and you can see the size of this wave. You can't determine how tall is that wave. It's hard to tell, isn't it? Because there's nothing to relate it to. But look at this picture. It's easier to relate this. There is a 12-story building. And this is a real picture. This is not graphic. This is an actual picture of the wave hitting the city off the coast of Africa. And this is a tsunami wave. This is probably half or a third the size of the tsunami waves that would have been during the flood, the Mabul, the great flood of Genesis. Because we remember at the beginning of that one video how the ocean floor opened up and the water spurted up. That's exactly how this wave was created. An underwater earthquake in the middle of the ocean that if you were out there on a ship, you didn't even feel the wave. All you felt was a gradual rise and fall of 15 to 20 feet. It's only as you approach land that the wave begins to form and the recession of the water and the moving forward of the water. This is the reality of what a tsunami can do. So you magnify that multiples of times during this Genesis flood and you get an idea of why some of the earth literally moved during this time, how mountains could have been formed. As water hit these land masses, it just drove the land up almost like a wave. And if you ever fly over the mountains, look down and notice how much the mountains look like waves on water. The force of this water hitting land masses and just kind of jamming them together. And these are the things that Whitcomb and Morris brought together when they began to research this in the early 50s. Henry Morris was a hydrodynamic engineer. He understood the force and the impact of water. And John Whitcomb was one who did not believe in the historicity of the Genesis flood or of the account of creation until he met Henry Morris. And he was teaching Old Testament theology and teaching what was called the gap theory, that evolution occurred between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And it wasn't until he met Henry Morris that he realized creation was an actual true 6-day event in the history of the world. So let's go to Genesis chapter 8. You want to do that? And if you notice Genesis 23:24 in chapter 7, it says, "Thus he blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky. They were blotted out from the earth. And only Noah was left, together with those who were with him on the ark. And the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Now, that's 5 biblical months of 30 days each. And it's the way the Bible records time. Through the whole rest of the Bible. Generally, when it speaks of years, it's speaking of 12, 30-day months. And God is careful to record this catastrophe in real time, in real place history, because it's not a story like once upon a time. The dates here are so specific to ground it as a historical event. So let's go to 8:1. Notice, but God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him on the ark. And God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. Now, there's a couple things here. The Lord remembered. That meant that he went off somewhere and he forgot that Noah was on the ark. God did not forget. God remembers means that the Lord was now ready to act based on a previous promise. And he made that previous promise to Noah in chapter 6, verses 18 and 19, when he said to him, I will establish my covenant with you. Covenant. That's a covenant promise. First use of the word covenant in the Bible is in Genesis 6:18. He says, I'm going to make a promise with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. That's a promise. You're going to go into this ark that you build. And of every living kind of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark. Why? To keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. And you're going to live and they're going to live. That's God's promise. Now God remembered that he had made this promise. Now they have to live through this flood. They have to live through this great catastrophic event. They have to get to the other side. And that's what he says he's going to do. So the promise that God made to him is literally true, just as the rest of the account is true. Because if the account's not true, then the promise isn't true. So now look again in 8:1. Something else changed. There's something else new in the account of Genesis. The word wind. God caused a wind to pass over the earth and the water subsided. And the wind is a force now in weather. Because weather means temperature alterations, and it's wind that is necessary to produce rain. And before this, there's no rain. So these things are new. It's a feature of this new world that is now going to exist from that point on. Now let's go to 8:3 and 4. Notice it says that the waters recede. The waters receded steadily from the earth, and at the end of 150 days, the waters decreased. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark rested, not upon, literally, it's the word over the mountains of Ararat, because the waters are still going down. So God had caused the ark to rest over Ararat. So it's still over it on the water, but that's where it's going to end up as it floats down. And again, this is another geographical marker. Moses is not only giving a specific day, he's giving a specific place that the readers of this time would have gone, oh yes, we know where that is. That's not a made-up mythical place. It's a real place. And then the water began to recede, and then Moses had to wait 40 more days after that. So that's in 6 through 12. It came about at the end of 40 days. Noah opened the window of the ark, which he had made, because he could see things were dying down. They were receding. The rain had come to an end. And verse 7, notice, he sent out a raven, and it flew about until the water was dried up from the earth. And then he sent out a dove to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. And the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot. So she returned. And the water was on the surface of all the earth. And then he put out his hand and took her, and he brought her into the ark. And he waited another 7 days, sent her out again. She came back, this time with a picked olive leaf, it says in verse 11. That means that something now was growing. When he sent her out the first time, there's nothing growing. She comes back now with growth. So he knew that the water was now abated, was receding. In verse 12, he waited another 7 days. So this 21 days has gone by. And he sent out the dove and she didn't come back. Because the dove found dry ground. And this is the difference between a raven and a dove. A raven is going to land on a carcass and go from carcass to carcass. And the raven doesn't care if he sleeps in the mud. He'll eat the carcass. The dove is a very clean bird. Needs a place of dry trees, dry land before it's going to rest on the earth. So he knew when this dove didn't come back, it was okay to get off the ark. So Noah in 13, he opens it up. He opens everything up. It came about in the 601st year. Notice this, on the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. Noah removed the covering and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. Now you would think he would just get off the ark now because he saw the earth was dry. No, he stays on the ark until the Lord tells him to leave. Look at verse 14. In the second month of the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. Then God said to Noah, now go out of the ark, you and your wife and all your sons and your sons' wives with you, and bring out every living animal. And here's what he says at the end of verse 17, that they may breed abundantly on the earth, be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. He wants them to spread out like they did before, to just cover the earth with this life. So Noah went out in verse 18. His sons, his wife, and his sons' wives with him. They leave. Everybody's safe. Noah, his family, animals, just like God had promised back in chapter 6. He kept his promise. Now, look at this on a timeline. If you look at all this on a timeline, what this says is that on 2:17, on the 17th day of the second month, the flood begins. This is in the 600th year of Noah's life, water covered the earth for 150 days. The next thing that happens is the ark rests over and then finally upon Mount Ararat as the water recedes. That's in the 17th day of the seventh month. We call that July 17th, just for laughs. Hovering over that for 114 days before it finally comes to rest on the ground. And then Noah sends out this raven and the dove. And this takes another 106 days before this whole process to complete, the 40 days of sending out the dove. And he begins that on the 10th day of the 11th month. So notice how time is being marked off very carefully here. It's not an accident. These are real days. And these aren't days of millions of years. These are literal 24-hour days. Now God tells him to leave on the 27th day of the second month, and that's when Noah was in his 601st year. So it's been 370 days since he got on the ark and the flood began. 370 days, more than a year, even in our time. But in the Bible, that would be 12 months and 10 days. Now, Noah obeyed the Lord by building the ark. But now, Noah worships the Lord by building an altar. And look at 8:20. Noah built an altar to the Lord and took every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. Another first in the Bible. This is the first mention of the word altar. First mention of the word ark, obviously, and altar. So you think, ark and altar. Noah built both as firsts. Now notice it says here that Noah offered a burnt offering. What's that mean? That's a very specific word. That in Hebrew is a first in Genesis. Again, remember, Genesis is the book of beginnings, where we get all our starts. And it's the word olah. And it means burnt offering. It means to burn up, to go up. Now, the burnt offering is a whole offering. The whole animal is burned completely. It's burned as a gift. The burnt offering is not linked with sin. The olah is not a confession of sin. Noah is not offering a sacrifice for his sins or the sins of his sons. He's offering the sacrifice as a gift of God. It's an expression of joy, celebration, worship, whatever word you want to use. And Noah is actually giving back to the Lord the animals that the Lord had given him as just this set of clean animals without really explaining why he was taking these clean animals on the ark. In fact, I think somebody asked that. Why is he bringing these seven clean animals onto the ark? Here's the answer to the question. In reality, Noah is saying everything belongs to you. Everything we have, everything we are now belongs to you. Even today, when we worship him with what he has given us. He's pleased with that. And notice, we know that because of what it says in verse 21. The Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and the Lord said to himself, and remember, when the Lord speaks to himself, he's always speaking to the other two persons who are always with him, the Holy Spirit and Jesus Christ. I will never again curse the ground on account of man. On account of man. Notice that. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. Now, first of all, I want to point out, this sacrifice is a pleasing aroma in his nostrils. This is attributing to God physical characteristics that he really doesn't have. We can understand that. When we smell something burning, we either go, ooh, that stinks, or, oh, that smells great. It depends on what's cooking. And this is very satisfying to God. And he makes a promise, I will never again curse the ground. Because why? Because it's the heart of man that is cursed with sin. And so he promises never to destroy mankind with a worldwide flood again. But notice, by what he says here, that the flood, this great mabul, and I always remember that word, mabul, it's a fun word anyway, did not eradicate sin from the world. Did you notice that? There's still sin in man. Water does not cleanse us from sin. Only blood can cleanse us from sin. Really what the rest of the Old Testament teaches us. Now look at this, what the Lord promises in verse 22. While the Lord remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer, winter, day and night shall not cease. These things shall not cease. Let me restate that. The Lord promises, as long as the earth remains, these things, changing temperatures, which didn't exist before, seasons, cold and hot, didn't exist before. because it's temperature variation that produces wind. This is new. And time itself, night and day. Remember, the first day one was the beginning of time. That's not going to end. That's the promise I'm making. One more thing here. What 2 Peter says doesn't contradict what God has said. The earth is going to be destroyed. But God promised it's not going to be destroyed with water.
Right.
Peter says that's right. God's going to keep his promise. He destroyed the world with water at one time, but he's going to destroy the world in the future with fire. And so what he says there is something very revealing. He's talking about people in the last days mocking the second coming of Jesus Christ. But their reasoning is that everything's been the same from the beginning of creation. These people are uniformitarians. Evolution teaches a uniformitarian evolution of things over time that brings us to where we are today. These people are saying nothing has ever happened since the beginning of creation. Everything's always been the same. And notice what he says here. It escapes their notice that the earth was formed out of water and by water, and it was through water that the world was destroyed with water, with the great flood. But the present heavens and earth are being reserved, being safeguarded by God for the final day of judgment, which is going to be with fire and the destruction of ungodly men. And of course, the destruction of ungodly men is the same language you find in Genesis. I'm going to send the flood to destroy the ungodly men and all their ungodly deeds. So let's look at one more thing. Let's look at the timeline I gave you. And this is very hard to see up here. That's why I put it in your hands. And this is a timeline of the relationship between Noah and his forefathers. But notice Noah. First find Noah. I'm going to highlight these people in different colors. And they're going to be pastel colors. I hope you like them. But notice Noah. Now Enoch, if you find him, that's Noah's great-grandfather. Now he is translated, or we would say raptured, before Noah is born. Now find Methuselah. Enoch's son is Methuselah, Noah's grandpa. Now, I'm sure that Grandpa Methuselah got Noah on his knee and told Noah about Enoch and said, "My daddy didn't die. He just disappeared." And Noah's dad is Lamech. And Enoch was Lamech's grandpa, the guy who disappeared. That was Lamech's grandpa. So as a good father, Lamech probably taught Noah about Enoch's preaching. Remember how we looked at Enoch's preaching? And Enoch preached that the judgment is coming. Noah might have asked, well, why is Grandpa's name Methuselah? And Lamech is going to tell him, well, his name is Methuselah because it means when it comes, he dies. And notice this, Adam. Adam is still alive during Enoch, Methuselah, and Lamech. Adam could have been one who could have told his ancestors, his children, and his children's children, here's why things are the way they are. Your grandmother and I ate some fruit we were not supposed to eat, and we are suffering the consequences of that. So they would have had oral, handed down accounts of the real creation event. When it comes, he dies. What that means is when the flood comes, when the flood begins, in the year that Methuselah dies, that's when the flood's going to be. And that's exactly what happened. And if you'll notice there that Lamech actually dies before Methuselah dies. Now, Noah and his family, they live on after the flood. And Noah lives to see the Tower of Babel in the life of a man named Peleg. And Peleg means division. Of course, this is when the nations are divided. We're going to see that in Genesis chapter 10 and 11 when we get there. Now, I want to look at one final relationship, Abraham, or Abram, down near the bottom. And notice this, Noah is still alive when Abram goes to Canaan. So, how do you think, perhaps, Abram might have known about the flood, which then he could pass on to Isaac, which then he could pass on to Jacob, which then he could pass on to Joseph, which then, who came out of the family of Jacob is Moses later on. All these handed down accounts through these men. Now take this chart home and analyze it, because the relationship between these men of the early days of Genesis, I think, is amazing. And you know, the one thing I did notice the three faithful men that is talked about in the book of Genesis, Enoch, Methuselah, and Lamech. These three faithful men walked with the Lord. They walked with the Lord before the flood, and they did not die in the flood. You notice that? But Noah and his family did not die before the flood. They were rescued through the flood. Notice the contrast in the book of Genesis between Enoch, Methuselah, and Lamech, where the focus there is that these men walked with God, as opposed to in that family of Cain, they developed the technology of the brass implements and the music and the culture and the cities. Is these are the things that we have a tendency to boast in. We don't really boast about someone we know that walks with God. So these men weren't popular men, but look at how God elevates them in the Scriptures. They walk with God. That's the greatest thing you can say about someone. Great contrast in the whole account of Genesis here. Just some conclusions. I'm going to make two conclusions. The flood covered the earth. The language of Genesis speaks to that. It's in universal terms. The amount of water, the water covered the earth. We saw that last week. 22 feet over the tops of the mountains. Peter's testimony, we saw that, where he says the world was destroyed with water. God's promise to the whole earth, we see that. And you know, if the flood weren't true, and a true worldwide catastrophe, and only simply a local event, number one, Noah wouldn't have needed to build an ark. God could have said, look, there's going to be a flood coming to this Euphrates Valley. Why don't you pack up your family and go somewhere else? Why would he have to build an ark? It took 120 years to build. It was a local event. But the biggest problem with the local event, it makes the promise of God absolutely meaningless. If this is God's promise to the entire world, I will not again destroy the world with water. That's his promise to the entire world. That's a promise that includes even us. And if we don't take this promise as literally true, then the whole account is nonsensical. Which, isn't it interesting? The experts say it is nonsensical. It's only a myth. You know, this is the most important point of all. And I think this is where the tragedy of not teaching the flood account as a true biblical event is right here. The flood is verified by Jesus himself. And look at what Jesus says. Matthew 24, 37 through 39. The coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, they were marrying, giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them, how many away? All away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Is Jesus Christ coming back to earth and establishing his kingdom, is that a historical guarantee? Yes. And he says that's going to be just like the days of Noah. I think there's another thing I find to be absolutely amazing. Matthew 24, 25 compares the second coming of Jesus to the flood of Noah. And you know what I believe? That you should take Matthew 24, 25, those whole two chapters, read it alongside the account of the flood and see the parallels. Because Jesus builds everything he says in Matthew 24, 25 on the historical account of Noah. This is where he builds his promise of his second coming, the great flood of Genesis 6 through 9. All the prophecy he gives, all the parables he gives, and all the certainty about the kingdom that he will bring upon this earth are compared right there. To me, when you denigrate creation and the reality of the flood, you're denigrating the words of our Savior. Next week, we're going to look at Genesis 9, the new world of Noah, the new command, the new promise, and unfortunately, one more thing, a new curse.